Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Zen Buddhism by the numbers, number six, the six paramitas, dana, generosity, Sila, discipline, kshanti, patience, virya, energy or exertion, jhana, meditation, zen, prajna, wisdom. From Bodhidharma's outline of practice, the fourth practice, what does it mean to practice the Dharma? The Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist. The sutras say the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being. And the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. Those wise enough to believe and understand this truth are bound to practice according to the Dharma. And since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in charity, without regret, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. And to eliminate impurity, they teach others, but without becoming attached to form. Thus, through our own practice, they're able to help others and glorify the way of enlightenment. And as with charity, they also practice the other virtues. But while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what's meant by practicing the Dharma. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's really warm today, isn't it? It's quite something. So, I first started coming to New York Zendo to give talks about a dozen years ago, in 2011. And the first series of talks that I gave, I didn't really know what to talk about. Koan practice has not been a focal point in my Dharma development. And so just going through koans the way most Rinzai Zen teachers do didn't seem appropriate to me. And I thought, well, what is it that Zen students of all levels of experience might benefit from? And I came up with this plan of something I called Zen Buddhism by the numbers, which is essentially all of the ideas, Dharma teaching points in Buddhism that are in one way or another attached to a number. So for example, for Mu, the number zero seemed obvious. For one, for two, for three, for four, there was always something that could easily slot into the number And for the number six, there were two lists that Buddhism has that seemed really appropriate. And the first was the six paramitas. The second is the six worlds. And I'll talk about the six worlds tomorrow. But the six paramitas, the word paramita generally is translated as perfection. It can easily be translated as virtue. They're the qualities that are developed through our practice and the qualities which our practice really relies upon. They're the qualities of the bodhisattva. And I listed them at the beginning of the talk. The first is dana, charity, or generosity. The second is sila, which can be translated as discipline, or ethical discipline, or morality. And it refers specifically to the practice and maintaining of precepts. Kshanti is usually translated as patience, although it can also be translated as perseverance or forbearance or fortitude. Virya usually is translated as energy or exertion or zeal. Jhana is literally meditation, and it's the root word from which we get the word Zen. You can kind of hear the similarity. If it came to China as Chan, Jhana Chan, and then in Japan as Zen. And prajna is wisdom. And in looking back over the years, I gave the series of lectures, Dharma talks on the Zen Buddhism by the numbers about a dozen years ago. And I thought, well, it's just about time to revisit. I'm different. My practice has matured in some ways. You're all different. Some of you were here when I gave the first series of lectures. I know Kokan and Genkai were here, and Koge. But most of you weren't. And so I thought, well, these are talking points that are really important for everyone. And I'm a very big believer in just going back to the basics. You know, we sometimes make Dharma practice a lot harder than it needs to be. We make it a lot more complicated than it needs to be. And really, it's there are a lot of very basic ideas and basic practices . The paramitas are definitely in that group of basic ideas, basic things to know about how we are meant to live and practice and relate to each other and relate to ourselves. So, looking for a text that brings out the fundamental nature of the paramitas, I went back, as I often do, to Bodhidharma and his outline of practice. So, some people here are relatively new and may or may not have heard of Bodhidharma before. Bodhidharma is this fellow over there. looks rather dour. He's almost always depicted as being rather dour, which is kind of funny. I guess there are a few koans in which he seems rather dour, very demanding, very hard and unapproachable, like a cliff. But I don't really think that he is. I think what makes us think of him as dour is our inability to get into the mind of emptiness, the mind of Bodhidharma. I think once you get into that mental framework, then he seems very refreshing, very honest, very simple. So this text, the fourth practice in his outline of practice, he gave a lot of lectures and sermons and sayings, and there are all kinds of legends about him. He's really considered the first patriarch or first ancestor of the Zen lineage. Even though Buddhism had been flourishing for a very long time before he was born, there were 28 Indian ancestors before Bodhidharma came to be. And we almost never talk about any of the Indian ancestors except, of course, the first one, Shakyamuni Buddha. Once in a while, we might mention Ananda or Mahakashyapa, but in general, we kind of gloss over all of that period of Buddhist practice. Because in the mind of the Far East part of Asia, which would include Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, all of these places where some version of what we think of as Zen is practiced, or at least was practiced. The Indian way of being and practicing is really not thought of very much. The form that we have comes to us largely through an amalgamation of Chinese native thought and religious practice. There are a lot of Taoist influences in Zen. And the complicated history of state sponsorship followed by state persecution followed by state sponsorship followed by state persecution that really formed the milieu of Chinese Chan and which formed the basis for the kind of Buddhism that was taken from China into Japan. So Bodhidharma, although he was, as far as we know, probably northern Indian, is considered the first Chinese ancestor. And aside from the many legends told about Bodhidharma, the actual texts that come from him, or at least are attributed to him, are relatively few. There are four sermons, and one outline of practice. And the outline of practice is really short. It's only about 2 or 3 pages long in translation. And this is the only text from Bodhidharma that pretty much all scholars, at least the ones who haven't convinced themselves that Bodhidharma was a fiction from start to finish, most scholars agree that he probably did say these things, this outline of practice. His other sermons are a little more controversial, but the outline of practice, it's a pretty nice little summary of Bodhidharma's thought. And this is the final portion of the outline of practice, the fourth of the four practices that he talks about. He says there are two ways of entering into Dharma, two ways of entering into Zen. One is through reason, which means you've heard the Dharma and it just makes sense and you believe it and it seems completely natural and there you go. You've entered into Zen through reason. I have to say that doesn't happen very often. Pretty rare, actually. One of the few examples that we have of that is the sixth patriarch, who apparently was a poor, illiterate son of a widow, his father having been exiled and died young. His father had been a high government official, fell out of favor, the family went into exile, the father died quite young. Weineng, or Eino as he's called in Japanese, was collecting firewood. That was how he supported his mother, collecting and selling firewood. So he had collected firewood and went to the village market. And he heard a wandering monk or priest reciting or chanting the Diamond Sutra. And just hearing that, a light went off. And he had a complete enlightenment experience. So you could say that he entered by reason. He heard the Dharma, he completely understood the Dharma, he completely got it, and then it was just a matter of going off and finding a teacher who could verify that he understood and to give him the finer points of how this practice is carried out. But that story is, first of all, too good to be true, and secondly, very, very rare. Most people have to practice. And by practice, we mean they have to sit, they have to hear Dharma, they have to study Dharma, they have to give themselves to the Dharma, and eventually, by giving themselves to the Dharma gives itself to them. That's the way it usually works. And Bodhidharma talks about 4 different ways of practice. There's suffering and justice. And essentially, suffering and justice just means being alive, because that's what it means to be alive. We're constantly beaten up by life. one thing after another. And we can complain about it. We can say, why is this happening to me? I didn't do anything wrong. And we can bitch about it all we want. And it changes absolutely nothing. Or we can say, okay, this is reality. And maybe it's happening because I did bad things in another life. Or maybe it's happening because that's just the way things go. But what do I do now? Your feeling about suffering injustice, feeling about suffering for no good reason. It may be a chronic illness, maybe the death of a loved one. It may be discrimination because of your age or your race or your sex or your gender or your political affiliation or your religion. We're constantly suffering what seems to be completely unwarranted. Constantly having some pain in our soul that is just there. Sometimes inflicted upon us from without, sometimes inflicted upon us from within. And how you suffer these injustices and take responsibility for them and learn to use them as a means to opening your heart to yourself and opening your heart to others, understanding how the world works, growing compassionate because of it. That's the first practice he talks about. And he talks about seeking nothing. Seeking nothing. Having no gaining idea. Having no idea of, I need this to be happy. Or if only this were to happen, then everything would be okay. When you give up that idea, it's very liberating. Another of the practices is adapting to conditions. And this is very similar to the first two ideas of suffering injustice and wanting nothing. He says, we don't make the world the way we want it to be. We don't rule the world, we don't even rule ourselves. We're ruled by conditions. The person that we are, with whatever good points or bad points we have, whatever richness, whatever poverty, whatever anger, whatever fear. All of these qualities have been caused not by our saying, well, today I'm going to be angry. Or today I'm going to be scared out of my wits. These things just happen because of conditions. And the conditions are a vast network starting with the Big Bang and working up to right now. And all kinds of things enter into it, genetics and epigenetics and rearing and what you ate for breakfast and are you hungry? Did you sleep well? All of these conditions, most of which we have very little, if any, control over. And that's how we're created. That's how we are made into the being that is here right now. And yet somehow we think that we're in control. If we give up this idea of we're in control and realize that conditions are fluctuating, and in their fluctuation, we are also fluctuating. We are also changing. As conditions change, we change. That's an essential point to becoming mature, which is another way of saying becoming sane. And happy. Realizing that everything is change and that we change constantly, even though this funny thing that we have called memory convinces us otherwise. And that brings us to the fourth practice, which I'll talk about. The fourth practice is practicing the Dharma. So what's the Dharma? It's a word that has a lot of different meanings. It can be used to mean phenomena. It can be used to mean the true nature of phenomena. It can be used to mean the entirety of Buddhist teaching or the law as propounded by Shakyamuni Buddha. Bodhidharma says the Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. This is the truth, that all natures are pure. The Heart Sutra says nothing is pure, nothing is defiled. Bodhidharma says all natures are pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. So these two sentences are enough, really, for an entire teisho, and enough for many, many periods of zazen. All natures are pure and all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist. The sutras say the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being, and the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. Includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being, and no self because it's free from the impurity of self. So what does that mean? Well, remember that I said everything depends on conditions. And conditions are constantly in flux, constantly changing. You can't hold on to anything. You know, try to grab the wind. And even though we think of some things as being permanent, like mountains, it's just our limited viewpoint that makes us think that. You know, the Catskill Mountains, where Daibosatsu is, scientists say they used to be higher than the Himalayas. So what happened to that? Just wind and rain, snow, sun. And suddenly the Himalayas are just gentle rolling hills. And the James Webb Telescope, you know, has sent back pictures to us from billions of years ago, many billions of years ago, when the universe was still new. The funny thing about the universe that because it started as a single point, everything in the universe is as far away from us as any other point in the universe. But if you look back billions of years, what you're seeing are stars that were being formed. And we're seeing them as just little stars, just being born. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of those stars are already dead and gone. We're seeing empty appearances. Because when your point of view is expansive enough, all appearances are empty. If there's another civilization a few billion light years away from us, they might be looking at us and seeing our sun being born. All appearances are empty if your point of view is expansive enough. Of course, we don't usually have such an expansive point of view. We usually have a very limited point of view. And our limited point of view is usually governed by things like what we ate for breakfast, how we slept last night. Did we read some trash on Twitter that made us angry? And we take what we see in this limited point of view as truth, as real. Not just real, but important. And we want everybody else to agree with us about how important this truth is and how real it is. And what are you going to do about it? And all because we start off with this limited idea of me. I. Not seeing that this me and this I is just one more of those conditions that are constantly fluctuating, constantly changing. And when we think about it, we can see how we're constantly changing. We can look at pictures of ourselves when we were 6 years old and say, oh, yeah, I remember those times. Of course, you don't really remember them. You have some funny idea about what those times were like, but you no longer have the mind of a six-year-old or the heart of a six-year-old, and so you can't really remember them. But you think that you are the same person that you were when you were 6 years old, even though now you may have illness, arthritis, acid reflux, losing your hair, losing your mind, but still you have some idea of permanence, that you are this being that was born at this specific time, rather than this constantly fluctuating collection of emotions, ideas, physical processes. But the Dharma is this wider perspective. The Dharma sees all natures as pure and all appearances as empty. Empty of self. Empty because they are impermanent and passing away. Empty because they can't be held onto. Empty because they are an expression of relationships, interdependence. You may think of yourself as yourself, but yourself is your parents and your grandparents and their grandparents and the country that you live in, the country you grew up in, the things that you've studied, the things that have been told to you, the things that you desire, the things that you fear. All of these things outside yourself are yourself. You're vaster than you think. You are connected in ways both gross and subtle to everything. You're a vast network that, for reasons of expediency, has chosen to think of itself as simply a very local process, a very local phenomenon. This body. This body is incredibly vast. But we don't see it that way because otherwise, what size pants would we wear? What would we eat if we had to fill the entire universe? So our limited perspective allows us to function in the world, but it also confuses the hell out of us. if you really understand this pure nature of the Dharma and the vastness of each one of us, how would this affect how we treat each other? How would it affect how we treat ourselves? The easiest way to realize the Dharma is to practice Zazen. And the easiest way to embody the paramitas is to practice Zazen. All of the paramitas, dana, shila, kshanti, virya, jhana, prajna, all of those are present in your Zen practice. You don't have to go out and give things away. You don't have to go out and embody all of the precepts. Just being here on the cushion is already a perfect expression of the paramitas. On the other hand, the paramitas are also the way in which we can, through our actions, through our behavior, through our being in the world, put the Dharma into practice. So I'll talk a little about each of the paramitas in turn. I want to focus mostly on dana because dana, generosity, is the first paramita that is listed, and in some ways the most important paramita. It's in some ways the opening to all of the others. It's like the first step. You can't go on a journey without taking the first step. And dana is the first step. Bodhidharma says, with charity, they also practice the six other virtues. And about charity, he says, since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, nothing worth holding on to, since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in charity. Without regret, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. You could say that not just that which is real has nothing worth begrudging, but in order to realize what's real, you have to give away your life. You have to give away your body. You have to give away your money. You have to give away everything And of course, I'm not saying that you have to leave yourself penniless and go homeless. But the impulse to hand over whatever you can hand over in the service of the Dharma. And on the simplest level, on the crudest level, this means being generous in terms of possessions. The Japanese monks still practice takahatsu, which is begging, going from place to place with their faces covered by these large hats, so that the person who is being asked to give cannot see who's being asked to give, and they can't see who's giving. So this is without regard to giver or recipient. And everything is accepted, however rich the donation or however meager. And they do that in order to give people the opportunity to realize the virtue of dana, to realize the virtue of charity. And we practice dana, of course, when we contribute money to the Zen Study Society. Certainly the Zen Study Society always needs money. There's a monastery restoration campaign underway, which is still underfunded. Every year we run a deficit. So this kind of generosity is very much appreciated. But the real generosity is showing up. The real generosity is being here, supporting the Dharma with your body, your mind, and your heart. Being here, supporting others in their practice by being here. It's hard to sit by yourself. I hear that from people all the time. In a community, it's much easier. But the community depends on the generosity of all of the people within it. The generosity not only in terms of material possessions, money, etc., but the generosity to do the work, to be present, to sit in the Zendo. And this generosity is the way in which we survive the poison of greed. It's the antidote to the poison of grasping. It's the impetus to loving kindness. And the fruition of loving kindness. Offering one's heart. And only when you really offer your heart, you offer your mind, you offer your body, only then does the Dharma begin to reveal itself to you. Only then do you develop the stability of heart and mind that allows you to be sane in an insane world. So that's Donna. When you sit here in the Zendo, it's perhaps the most pure expression of Donna. You are offering yourself. You are offering yourself to the Sangha. You're offering yourself to the Dharma. You're offering yourself to the Buddha. You're offering your mind to the Buddha mind, and the Buddha mind will offer itself to you. You're offering your body to the Sangha, and the Sangha will offer itself to you. You're offering your heart to the Dharma, and the Dharma will offer itself to you. And all of the other paramitas, all of the other perfections, can be understood in this way also. The discipline of Shila. Literally, it means the discipline of following the precepts. But it also means the discipline of doing what needs to be done regardless of how you may feel about it. And that may mean sitting when you don't really feel like sitting. Staying on the cushion when you really don't feel like staying on the cushion. Not moving when you really feel like moving. Keeping silent when you really feel like talking. Speaking with kindness when you really feel like just lashing out. All of these are discipline. Kshanti, patience. Patience or perseverance or forbearance, fortitude. In the Christian listing of virtues, the seven virtues, it's usually listed as fortitude. And this is certainly developed in Zazen. All of the times that you may feel like, I can't keep doing this, it hurts too much, or I can't keep doing this, my brain's racing around like a ferret. But you just sit there and you watch what's happening and you watch how it changes. And then time passes and you say, that wasn't so bad. All of the six virtues are expressed in their purest form in Zazen. And in practicing Zazen and expressing these virtues, we're practicing how to carry that mind and that heart into the world at large. It may not seem sometimes, and particularly doesn't seem to people outside who don't do the practice. They may wonder, why in the world are you doing this? It's kind of nuts. You just sit there and don't do anything. You know, what do you get out of that? How is that somehow spiritual? You're just doing nothing. And Bodhidharma says that. but while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. It's true, you're practicing nothing at all. And yet somehow there's a revolution going on in your heart. There's a sea change going on in your mind, practicing nothing at all. And this is what's meant by practicing the Dharma.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.